Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron, and this is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? Are you okay? Yeah, I know, it's bad. Yeah, I know. It's going to get worse. I get it. The storms, the heat, the water rising, things dying. I get it. There's no stopping it now. How's it going? Good morning. Welcome to the show. We'll adapt, right? Hey, look, you know, and I don't want to be a dick about it, but I've never been happier not to have children. Maybe that's a song. Is that a character in a musical? I've never been happier not to have children. I don't know, man. I apologize. Good luck with what you're doing. I hope everything's okay. Today on the show, Danny Houston, the actor Danny Houston, Angelica's brother, right? Danny Houston, John Houston's son. So Danny's here. He will be here in a minute. You can hear him talk to me about, he's got this new film out that's, it's heavy, but it's beautiful. It's a film called The Last Photograph. And we talked about that and about other things, about being a Houston. How about some updates? You want some updates on things? I can fucking do that. Not a problem. I guess I am now at 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. 18 days off of nicotine. And I think it's all mental now, obviously. But it's powerful. The mental thing is powerful. There's just these moments where there are moments that happen where my brain's just sort of like, shouldn't we be doing something right now? Shouldn't you be doing one now? What's going on now? We've got a free second here. It's time to get a feeling. I got an open second. Let's fill it with something, or take it down a notch, or jack it up. Where's the substance? Where's the stuff in that free second? So that happens occasionally, and I'm just trying not to feed all those free seconds with food. Been doing a lot of cooking here at the house. I find that very comforting, gives me a certain, it's a meditative quality, it's creative, it's engaged, and I get to eat things at the end of it. Nothing like cooking for 3 hours and eating whatever you made in 7 minutes. But I've been doing a lot of food prep around the house, you know, trying out new things. Right now, I'm kind of festering about a marinade for some chicken thighs. What's going to happen with the chicken thighs in the fridge? Look, I know things are not great. I don't know how they get better. I'm sorry. But I do know that by the end of the day, I will figure out a marinade for my chicken thighs that doesn't have too much sugar in it. That I know is going to happen. It's the little things, folks. Also, thank you for all the mail, the email about clearing up. Got some email about the Seattle shows, that there was a massive thunder lightning storm. I knew that. I think I might have told you about that, with the lights going on and off and the ghosts. But then someone sent me an email saying that there's some indication that perhaps the Moore Theater is built over a graveyard of settlers that had been moved. So there it could be a poltergeist situation over there. Then somebody sent me an email about all the people who sweat on that stage and the spirits therein, including William Burroughs, Chris Cornell, Kurt Cobain, cats like that. Place has been around a long time. Some of these vessels, some of these structures have a bit of a spiritual residue that they collect, kind of like a giant orgone box, except they're not holding orgone energy. They're holding just the psychic shrapnel of the creativity that happened in the structure. Now, either you buy into that shit or you don't. Some days I do, some days I don't. You dig? Yeah, so I'm okay, man. And everything's settling down. My dopamine receptors, all the things, the synapses are leveling out. They're leveling off into what's really me. And physically, I'm back in my body with no way out except for the way out, which I'll just wait for. No rush on that one. So that's okay. As far as therapy goes, the EMDR sessions are interesting, and I believe they are working. I do. I believe that the EMDR, as we hold the buzzers, start target some trauma, hang with that, buzz, then where are we at now, dish that out, buzz, where are we at now, that arc of process through the sort of reintegrating of the trauma or whatever, dissipating it. What the EMDR is having an effect. I think it's okay. I think I'm going to be all right. Cats are all right. Maybe somebody can give me some insight. My older cats are shrinking. They're getting very skinny. Monkey's very skinny. He's getting very fragile. He's 15 years old. Is there something I should be doing? They're eating a lot. Everybody's running around. Everybody's having a good time. But apparently they have a hard time as they get older absorbing protein. They're on a very high protein diet and they're eating it. But he seems to be just diminishing before my eyes, though he's got a lot of personality still. And he's running around. Energy, everything's fine. He's skinny. Does anybody know? Don't speculate here. I need some real advice. I could Google it. I did. I could, I guess I could call the vet, but I don't know. Is there a way to fatten them up? I think I'm kind of blessed to have skinny cats. That's who I am. I can project my body dysmorphia onto cats. Like, I'm very happy that all my cats are lean and it has something to do with what I feed them. Buster is a large cat. He's not fat, but he's the younger one. But I just don't know if I'm doing the right thing. Maybe I shouldn't ask you. You know, maybe I should just do what everyone else does and do the proper research. I've really just been here at home, you know, trying to enjoy my life on a few days down. For some reason, I started rewatching Breaking Bad. I watched most of Bill Burr's new special last night at Royal Albert Hall. And I'm starting to realize, though, even after watching Burr's special, it's like, I am definitely not as fucking angry as I used to be for no reason. Like, the general flow of rage is different for me. I don't know if it's early onset dementia or I'm generally working through things. Maybe it's the EMDR. I don't know. But I'm just not, I do get seething and I do get angry and I do get anxious and I do get full of a certain amount of dread. But I'm not about to pop anymore. I don't know why that happened or whether I'm going to assume it's good. I don't know what to tell you in terms of how it happened, but it happened. Oh, yeah. Before I forget, all you fish fans, Betty has not given me a fish playlist. You know, the idea, sometimes people say things on this show and they don't manifest. I, on the other hand, have to figure out how to use Spotify. That's my project for the week. As the temperatures rise and the water rises and species drop dead around us, I think we're kind of lower on that list, but we're definitely on that list. I'm going to figure out how to make a Spotify playlist. Now I'm going to try to integrate my Instagram and my Spotify. As the world burns, rights are denied. People are caged. Hate blossoms. I'm going to be diligently trying to put together a Spotify playlist. Right? That's doing something, right? Fucking fuck. Chicken marinade. Thinking limes. I got a lime tree out back. I'm thinking limes. I'm going to start with limes. So here, what do we cover today? Cats are okay. Everybody's good. Old cats are a little lean. I'm well into no nicotine, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 days. I'm doing okay, leveling off. EMDR, working pretty well. Do not know what to marinate my chicken thighs in. World is ending. Betty Gilpin did not give me a fish playlist. The ghosts at the Seattle Moore Theater are probably there, but I think I summoned lightning. It wasn't just ghosts. I summoned lightning. I'll make it about me. I'd like to think I have that much power. Some of the stuff I'm doing is a little dicey, a little button pushing. I've gotten some emails about my final bit. Some concerned fan emails are just sort of like, we were laughing through it, but it felt wrong. Hey, you know what I mean? Come on. They're just words. Huh? Little less angry. Working on it. Working on stuff. So, Danny Houston is here. Danny Houston made a nice movie. He's been in a lot of movies. He's also on Succession this season. That show, I love that show, by the way. Oh, yeah, and I'm started Breaking Bad again. Okay, up to speed. Everyone's here. This movie, The Last Photograph, is a touching, dark movie. It's not, I don't know if it's dark. It's just heavy emotionally, but it's poetic. It's one of those movies that grown-ups like me enjoy seeing. It's exactly it is a beautiful, deep, moving, sad, independent film. But that movie, The Last Photograph, is now in theaters and on demand. And this is me talking to the star and director of that movie, Danny Houston.
Mine's a rickety old house in the Hollywood Hills that certainly has a life of its own.
Oh, so you've been up there a long time?
Yeah, probably about 15 years.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's a whole different life up there, it seems. I mean, that's the life that people think of when they think of Hollywood.
Well, I'm literally under the Hollywood sign.
You are?
I mean, I can't see it, but if you're looking at me, I can extend my arms wide open
and
hold it in the back of my... Yeah. I can't see it, but you can.
So if somebody's looking at you in front of your house...
Exactly.
I get it. Well, that's fucking nice. So 15 years, where were you before that? New York?
No, I was near Laurel Canyon.
Oh.
Near Wonderland.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wonderland, the street?
Mm-hmm.
The infamous street. The horrible
yeah.
Slaughter Street?
Yep.
That's weird. That's the point of reference. It's sort of like, I'm up by the old Tate House.
Yeah. You didn't mention the charming school.
That's what Hollywood's known for. Did you see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I loved it.
You did, right?
Oh, God, I loved it.
Because you grew up in some of that, right? I mean, In a way.
I grew up in Ireland and
lucky bastard. You lucky bastard.
Cheers. And Italy. And then I went to school in England. I came to Hollywood late. My father, you know, he lived in Ireland and then later in Mexico. But,
yeah.
But L.A. was always a sort of stopping point.
The Mexico period. It's so weird that the generation of your dad's, those guys, they just went to Mexico. It's like Peckinpah. Like, you know, I'm going to go, they had this romantic, I'm sorry, that's what I always associate the family, the Houston family, with this kind of strange adventuring thing.
Yeah.
International.
Well, I mean, growing up, I wasn't... Well, I guess I was clear that he was a director, but he'd come from sort of faraway countries, bearing gifts, and it was like a pirate coming to visit the house, and with tall tales, sort of swashbuckling kind of guy, Ireland he left sadly, you know, after about four or five marriages, I guess.
Where do you fall in? How is it like? Because I had your half-sister. She's your half-sister, right? Angelica, here.
Yeah.
Your mother was which wife?
My mother was, she wasn't a wife.
Oh.
My mother was in between wife number four and five, or either between five and six.
But you had a relationship with everybody.
Oh, yes, oh, yes. Okay. No, and my father and my mother were tremendous together.
Oh.
They were very close.
Yeah.
Yes, there was a lot going on.
Yeah. Always. But now, like, things have, I guess, settled down. But, like, when you started... where'd you grow up? Like, you were in Italy, like right in Rome?
I grew up in Rome because my father was making a film based on a rather well-known book called The Bible.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
and it was a long pre-production and post-production. The whole thing took about 3 or 4 years, and so I happened to be born there. I like to say that I was conceived... If we're using his films as a measuring stick, I was conceived during Freud, born during the Bible,
right.
and teethed on Night of the Iguana. I spent some time on the set of the Bible, and I remember watching the first cut, and one's father is a god. Probably for every son and daughter.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, the film starts, and I hear in the beginning, and it's my father doing the voiceover for God.
Right.
And then the next thing I knew, he was Noah.
Yeah.
And there were animals following him into the ark.
Right.
And this was just fantastic for me. And then my mother was also in it.
Yeah.
She plays Hagar.
Yeah.
And she's in the middle, in the desert.
Is that Noah's sister?
Abraham.
Oh.
And she's in the desert, dying of thirst. And suddenly, this kid appears, who's her son, and he's not me.
Right.
And at that point, I got very confused, and I've had that problem really all my life, trying to differentiate fiction from reality.
It's hard, right?
It is.
Like, I interviewed, there's a guy, who's the guy that wrote the big book on your family?
Larry Grobel.
Yeah, Grobel.
Yeah.
I interviewed him a while back. He was very, he's the big interview guy. And I remember I set out to interview the interviewer, and it went on a long time. And I'm not sure what I was looking for. I know that I had to, like, he came back again. Now, what was your? Did you like that book?
Yes, I think we all liked it. It at times delved possibly a little too deeply with interviews with others.
Mm.
I felt, but my favorite book biography was a book called An Open Book.
Uh-huh.
That my father wrote, and it's a wonderful collection of stories.
About the family or short stories?
It's a collection of stories from his life.
Ah.
And they're just marvelous. And we used to kid around saying, it's anything but an open book.
Right.
Because it doesn't reveal the sort of things that Larry Grobel.
Well, I didn't dent it. It was, it's a big book.
Mm-hmm.
And I will eventually get it.
You know, it's great. It's great from a, you learn a lot about Walter Houston.
Uh-huh. Your grandfather?
My grandfather.
I remember him from The Devil and Daniel Webster, right?
The Devil and Daniel Webster, that's right. And he was born in Toronto and his struggles. It's an interesting book from sort of, from my point of view, as a sort of piece of family history.
Sure. Well, yeah, it sort of fills in all the gaps, I would imagine, for you.
Yeah.
If someone else is doing the research.
Yes.
Like, I just did that. I did that show, Finding Your Roots. You know, it's a, where they do your genetic thing, and then they do the research on it. And it was interesting, but you had a guy do thorough research and, talk to everybody involved and incorporate it into the history of show business. That's a nice thing to have.
Yeah.
As a point of reference.
It is.
Even if he digs up some bad shit.
It was sometimes. You gotta.
There's bad shit there.
Yeah.
It's better to happen then than now.
Yeah, I think it creates a dramatic read.
So why? When did you realize that show business was the thing?
I felt somewhat doomed. You know, we just mentioned Walter, my father, Angelica.
Yeah.
My cool sister, Angelica.
Yeah. How much older is she?
About 10 years.
Okay, so she was in it, and you were like, whoa.
She was, I mean, yeah. as a kid, you know, she was, she still is incredibly cool, but
yeah.
She was friends with, like, the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I know.
and Jack Nicholson.
Right.
And so,
right.
So this was, you know, incredibly exciting for me. My nephew Jack Houston, it's kind of like the family business. So I mean, I resisted it for a while. I like to paint, and I sometimes saw my father struggle with the whole circus act that's around filmmaking,
right.
and the money involved. I could see that it caused him trouble from time to time, even though he knew how to play the game so beautifully. I mean, he was just a poker player.
Really?
He'd bluff and just
like in what situations? Well, like what was the education?
Well, I'll give you an example. I remember when he was making Pritzi's Honor.
Oh, great
with,
movie.
With Angelica.
Yeah.
And Jack, actually. A guy from ABC came up and said, "Mr. Houston, it's incredible. You're using such a low amount of footage, of film.
Yeah.
You're saving us so much in the budget by doing so." And he said, "Well, thank you very much. It's very kind of you." And then when the gentleman left the room, my father said, "Oh, idiot." he doesn't understand that they can't cut it any other way.
So it was a control thing.
Like he'd be cutting in the camera so that
they didn't have anywhere to go.
Any option, yeah.
Oh, that's smart.
And that's the kind of thing, you know, that sort of trickery.
And when you were coming up, like, so you started as a painter? Did you go to college?
I went to art school. I went to film school.
Oh, yeah?
In
Europe?
In London, yeah. Mm. And then I had this moment when he was making a film called Under the Volcano.
Oh, yeah. Albert Finney?
Albert Finney.
Yeah.
Based on a Malcolm Lowry novel. He was struggling with the title sequence. I used to make him cocktails or drinks, depending what country he was in, it would be a different drink.
Uh-huh.
In Mexico, it was a Cuba Libre, rum and coke, and I brought him a rum and coke, and it upset him. He said, "No! The coke should only color the rum." So I went back and poured him a large one, and then we watched the rushes.
Yeah, for Under the Volcano.
For Under the Volcano, And he was struggling with this title sequence because it was the papier-mâché dolls, but they didn't move. So it was the shots were very static for the title sequence. So he turned around to me and he said, "Danny, you've been to film school and stuff, right? Direct the title sequence." And I mean, it was almost a moment of horror for me.
Right.
But he handed over Gabriel Figueroa, who was a wonderful cinematographer.
Yeah.
I shot the sequence using a camera that moved around the dolls to try to create some movement. And he was delighted, and that was my first.
That was my first job. And were you like hooked? Were you like just because? Well, I mean, pleasing your dad's obviously a great thing. Mm. He dumped this thing on you, like you couldn't say no. And he showed up, and you nailed it.
I like to think I did, but I did come out of film school and stuff. So it was kind of my secret ambition.
You just didn't know how it was going to unfold. Where the confidence was going to come from. And then what? And then he produced the how long before you did the first feature?
The first feature I did with him was based on a Thornton Wilder,
and you directed that, right?
I directed that. It was called Mr. North,
right?
And I had a wonderful cast.
It was a big cast. I remember Anthony Edwards.
And again, my father. I mean. we were like two hustlers.
Yeah.
I remember presenting the script to Lauren Bacall, and there was a long flight of stairs.
Did you write the script?
No, he did.
Oh, your dad did.
Yeah, he did with Janet Roach, who's actually also wrote Prince's Honor with him.
Was it one of the things that he was intending to direct, or how did that, like?
No, I gave it,
Gave him the idea. Yeah. He said, all right, I'm going to write this.
Yeah.
And you're going to direct it.
That's right.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, so we got this great cast together. And yeah, Lauren Bacall, she was literally standing on top of a flight of steps outside the Westwood Marquee.
Yeah.
And I carried his oxygen tank up the steps.
What do you have, emphysema?
Yeah. I carried the oxygen tank up the steps towards Lauren Bacall.
Yeah.
And he turned around and winked at me and said, no way she's going to refuse this. and sadly... while we were making the film, he called me. He was meant to act in it.
Yeah.
And he called me. He said, yeah, Danny, you know, if I were to fall ill, is it okay if I get Robert Mitchum to stand by just in case? I said, well, look, I'm sure you're going to be fine. But yeah, sure, of course. And then he did become ill.
Oh.
Checked into the hospital in Newport, Rhode Island. And
while you were shooting?
While we were shooting.
Oh.
Robert Mitchum arrived, came to the hospital. They spoke, and Mitchum said, "You know, I'm sorry about the circumstances, yeah. But I'm here."
Yeah.
And when Mitchum left the room, my father lowered his oxygen tank, looked at me, and said, "Biggest hoax I ever pulled." And you know, he considered Mitchum one of the greatest actors.
Yeah,
and couldn't believe that he got him. But this was also a show of bravado
right.
a show of support. And he was such a gentleman.
Yeah.
In that regard.
Did he get well, or was that?
He got well for a short time.
Hmm. And so, like, what sort of like fascinates me about. Not, you know, the choice in like something like even like Mr. North, and then again with the new movie which I watched, the Last Photograph.
Yes,
is that there, and even in some of the movies your father made that were is that these stories are very specific. They're not mainstream stories necessarily. They're stories like, because I have this big rant going on, you know, actively in public about the limitations of, you know, mainstream cinema because of the bullying element of, you know, comic book movies and, you know, what independent film means and where it can go. And I realize that some of this stuff, like your dad and even like, I think Mr. North did okay, right? Because,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, he had good actors in
Absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, yeah.
But then as you move forward, like watching The Last Photograph, I was like, this is a powerful movie. It's very moving. You know, it's beautiful to look at. It's challenging in a lot of ways, but it's not like a story that you just don't, these type of movies are they're hard to see anymore, like in movie theaters.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
It's true. Yeah.
But I mean, I thought it was an amazing movie, and I'm glad I watched it before you came. But like, even with something like Mr. North, you know, and then something like this thing that The Last Photograph, which you wrote and directed and acted in. How do you like, you know, how do you decide to commit to that story? You know what I mean? It's sort of like it always baffles me when I talk to directors where they have this thing and it's sort of like they're because it's going to take years.
Yeah,
and you got to lock in. I mean, obviously you're acting and doing other things, but what was it that sort of, what was it about that story? Like, let's talk about the last photograph, the newest movie.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying, by the way. It's, you know, my father was just spectacular the way he'd be able to make, you know, Wise Blood.
And Fat City, too.
Fat City and Under the Volcano, but yeah. In between all those three,
right.
He got in Annie.
Right.
So he really knew how to play, you know, giving one to them and keeping a couple for himself.
Right.
Keeping himself interested in new material.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out new ways to make films.
And that the last movie, what, The Dead?
Yes. Like, spectacular.
Yeah.
But also able to throw out, you know, Annie, Escape to Victory, Dino De Laurentiis, The Bible. He was also able to, so he was really able to play that game.
Right, right.
So with The Last Photograph, it was an idea that a friend of mine, Simon Astaire, gave me as a gift, really. It was a beautifully written screenplay. And with that...
it was his screenplay.
Yeah, it was Simon Astaire's screenplay. And I saw it as an opportunity to play, get back in the saddle.
Yeah.
And play with different mediums. Not necessarily for stylistic reasons, but for reasons of necessity. Mm. And so I used a Canon still camera to shoot London and during Christmas. I then used different
with film.
Digital, okay. A little digital. Yeah. And then I used a 16mm for the scenes with the kids in the park. I used probably about six or different types of equipment.
Was that on film? The 16?
Yes, it was. Of course, yeah. Now, of course. Of course, technology is so advanced that you can make anything look like anything.
Yeah.
But I liked the idea of actually holding equipment that was older,
right.
and it forcing me to see things possibly slightly differently.
And your character has that element to him too, that he's stuck in the past a bit.
That's right.
In grief, but also it seems in his shop as well.
Yeah, exactly. And the different formats also allowed me just to not to have things like place cards or dates, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And hopefully emotionally, the film is at times possibly a little languid. I could keep the emotion, stretch the emotion without giving you more information on this.
I thought that was very effective because, you know, there's a good chunk of the movie where you don't really know what happened.
Exactly.
Like there's pieces given to you, kind of, but it's really about the poetry of grief, right? And the maintaining of that and moving through it.
Yeah, and this guy, he owns a bookshop. He's a quite curmudgeonly, kind of maybe probably unpleasant kind of guy.
Yeah.
This photograph is stolen, and he spirals. He just goes into complete panic, and then while he's searching for this photograph, the film becomes a sort of a tapestry, a collage of memories, that lead one to this sort of fateful night, which December 22nd, 1988, when Flight Pan Am 101 exploded over Lockerbie.
Right. Yeah, and it's like the whole thing is sort of like there's I just had a conversation with somebody else about human beings and about, you know, how we avoid the sort of realities of death. Mm. In terms of that conversation was about how, like, you know, elderly people don't die in the homes anymore. Everything's sort of geared towards, you know, not paying attention.
Yeah.
So when you see, you know, a man, this character you played, kind of like not being able to let go and having death hoisted upon him, you know, in such a dramatic and public and, shocking way, it was surprising. For me, it was very sort of emotionally satisfying in its sadness because you really play it all the way through. I mean, in acting that, I mean, that must have been somewhat difficult. Was it for you?
Well, yes.
And also to direct and at the same time.
That was a little schizophrenic.
Yeah.
You're talking about death. The more mass shootings that we see, you see on the news channels, these photographs that come up.
Yeah.
And each one representing an individual story.
Right.
And that's what I found interesting about the concept that Simon Astaire brought to me. I knew, from a directing point of view, I knew that me, Danny,
yeah,
would be available as an actor.
Right.
And that I could shoot.
The easy casting.
Yeah. And that I could shoot at different moments.
Yeah.
Different times. So I could shoot London in the winter, and I could shoot London in the summer. And I knew that I had me.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons I cast myself.
Right.
Probably the primary reason I cast myself.
Right. You're scheduling issues.
Yes. I wouldn't have to get on the phone and say, hey, man. Can you do me a favor? I didn't have to do that because I was me. He's a hard character to take home because the state of he's kind of like a post stress
situation, right, exactly,
and the grieving is just is such that it's hard to shed, and one's bombarded with new last photographs all the time.
Right.
So it just became something that I was very aware of. And now that I talk about it, it's something that's I can conjure back. We've all lost friends, sadly, and family, et cetera. And we all have that last photograph. And so it's a hard thing to continue performing.
Right.
But from a directing point of view, it was exhilarating because I could use these different formats. I could dance around. I could shoot stuff in London. I could drive up to Scotland and shoot in Scotland. And
that was an insane scene where he's just in shock.
Yeah. But I could play. I could play from a directing point of view.
Right.
It's a little bit of an experiment, the film. Also, I was interested in creating a situation, an emotional thread that could lead me into live news footage without having to superimpose my character into the into the scene or anything like that, but actually create a situation where we didn't feel that we were cutting away to a news report.
But you mean when that guy came out and made the announcement?
Yes.
No, it worked really good.
Yeah, the nurses arriving, the ambulances, et cetera. Because, that's all real footage.
Yeah, no, it's great because like it even looked like the same room that you were in.
Exactly.
Almost.
Yeah. That's by design.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
No, that was great. Yeah. And the sort of relationship with there was a line in there that the actress
Sita Chowdhury.
Yeah, yeah. Who I hadn't seen in a while.
Yeah.
And you made this a couple of years old this
year,
right?
Yes.
It just took a while to its way.
It did.
But that line where she says, I believe it was her, where she says, you know, he was in love and he wanted more.
Yeah.
You know, it's really kind of like there's something about the poetry of the script that's pretty, you know, kind of like, you know, at every juncture, you know, you sort of feel it's sort of her outreach to your character to frame this as something that, you know, wasn't your fault, number one. And number two, you know, there's no way to explain it. There's no one to blame after a certain point. You know, how do you let that go?
Yeah, because he's guilt-ridden because he bought the ticket, et cetera.
And then the dynamic with the girl... With the girlfriend who's only, you know, who only knew him for 3 weeks is very profound as well because that she's going to carry that weight on a different level.
Yes, yes.
Oh my God.
I know. and I don't know whether, I've discussed this with the writer Simon a couple of times, but when she returns back in the story after years have passed.
Oh, and meets him at the church. Yeah.
I'm not sure whether he's imagining that or not.
Yeah, well, that's one of those things, right? Because it's actually in a joke I'm doing on stage now, because I'm a comic, where I talk about, you know, like about the difference between, you know, these big, huge Marvel movies, but like they're pushing us all to, we have to drive 25, 30 miles to, you know, to see grown-up movies in a theater situation where we can all have the experience together and walk out confused by the ending as one group of people. And that's, you know, what happened to those days? Did he die? Well, did she die? What happened? I don't know what happened. Why didn't they tell us? I think the director wants us to have this conversation. It was so one of those movies for me where, no, it was a poetic ending, so that was it. Like, you know, it's to create some, did he imagine, did he not imagine, was it real, was it not real?
Yes, and is he looking, I hate the word closure, but is he looking for some sort of peace within himself by imagining her and releasing her back to the love affair that she was having with his son?
Yes. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And does he, because there, you know, that shot of you at the end is not comforting.
No. The film is not a comforting film. It is not a Friday night popcorn movie. It is absolutely the antithesis of that.
But like, I'm really trying to, like, for myself, assess this kind of stuff and put it into, because, you know, I think I'm about your age. I'm 50. I'm going to be 56. You know, and you start to think about, like, well, what am I taking in? Why am I taking it in? What is important? What is art? What isn't art? You know, what? And, you know, when I saw how that your movie started, I was like, all right, well, this is what we're going to do here. This is, you know, this is something I'm going to have to sit with, and I'm going to have to allow. And I don't, you know, because in terms of the narrative, the story, it's really a poetry movie, because, you know, the story is like, you don't really, you don't ever think you're going to find the photograph.
Right.
And then it's a series of revelations that deepen the character's, you know, grief for the viewer.
Yeah.
But I really thought that, you know, like, through that and the way that you shot it, you know, and the way that you shot their romance, the kids' romance, and your relationship with the woman who works across from you, and even your old friend, that, you know, these become very, you know, loaded, and, you know, there is sort of small bits of relief and bits of connection that we all can have around the emotional process this guy is going through, and that is what it should be. You know, that is what the feeling should be. It doesn't have to be about, like, well, how's the story end, or what? You know, that is the poetry of film if you let it happen.
Yeah, and it's the reflective nature of it, I believe.
Of film.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're talking earlier about my father in Ireland, he'd get the projector out, and there's always a big sort of palaver about the film ripping or not, and then we'd project these films on the wall, and my grandfather, who I never met, was in Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and he was a gold prospector, and that's who I thought he was. You know, I thought my father was Noah. So film kind of lies and but also tells truths at the same time. And what I thought was interesting was this drive to the airport, driving my son to the airport. And it's a really quite a banal conversation. We're not saying anything that carries any great meaning.
That's where it starts, the movie.
Yeah, not saying, in a way, it's the spine of the film.
Right.
But then as we are informed, as the audience is informed, we see this conversation in a different way. Mm. I find it interesting how we find more symbolism, or we are more concentrated or intrigued by a conversation when we are informed what will happen.
How many features have you directed?
Three.
This is the third one?
Yeah, I mean, I started with a small 1-hour film, fresh out of film school, after I directed the title sequence, called Mr. Corbett's Ghost.
Uh-huh.
And my father was in it.
Where's that? Can you get it online?
Probably.
Yeah.
He plays a collector of souls, typecasting.
Yeah.
I have Paul Scofield in it, and I had Burgess Meredith. And,
oh,
and,
wow.
Wonderful. And then I moved on to Mr. North, where Lauren Bacall, Robert Mitchum, Harry Dean Stanton, David Warner, Mary Stuart Masterson, Virginia Madsen, a great, great cast. And then I made a film called The Maddening with Burt Reynolds and Angie Dickinson. And then I made another film called Becoming Colette, about Colette, with Klaus-Maria Brandauer. And by that point, I'd lost my father, who was my friend, my collaborator.
Yeah.
I found myself in a sort of rather seasonless state in Los Angeles.
Without your old man, you mean?
Without my old man, and without, I mean, years were going by. I was, you know, lots of meetings and phone calls and trying to get stuff going. But
you were acting, no?
No, I wasn't. I was in a complete funk. I was sort of flatlining, and I couldn't get anything off the ground. Waiting for this like eternal green light.
So the plan was directing.
Plan was directing,
right?
And then fellow directors, yeah, friends,
right?
Because of their kindness,
yeah,
really, started casting me in small parts,
right?
And then the parts got bigger, and suddenly I realized, oh wow, I should take this seriously.
I guess I'm acting.
Yeah, I mean, my the reason I said yes was because I was interested, because most of my film experience was on my father's film sets. So I was interested in experiencing how other people worked.
Yeah.
I worked with Mike Figgis and with Bernard Rose, who were more experimental in their approach. And kind of
Figgis on which one? On
Time Code.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's later,
yeah, where,
right?
Yeah, where we had a quadrant.
Right.
And we were writing the script.
Yeah, yeah.
Writing the script on music sheets.
That was, yeah. And you did, but you knew Figgis. He put you in Leaving Las Vegas
and
as well.
Yes, I was waiter number two.
And that was the first. Like he was throwing you a lifeline.
Yeah.
With that.
Yes.
He's like, you know, Danny's in trouble.
Yeah.
Got to keep his health insurance.
Exactly. Give him a part.
Sad.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, and then Bernard Rose and I, I worked with him on a version of Anna Karenina.
Yeah.
And he said he was having trouble with the cut on the film, and we were both in a very depressed state, moaning, groaning,
yeah,
about the film business.
Right.
And his girlfriend at the time said, you know, you guys are really boring. Why don't you just go out and make a film?
Yeah.
And we were like, no, you don't understand. It's far more complicated than that. You can't just go out and make a film. And she was like, well, I have. And she was a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
And so we tried this new camera out, this Sony digital camera that Sony lent us.
The Red?
No, earlier.
Oh, yeah.
And they used this sort of as a sort of testing. It was a trial.
Yeah.
And we shot this film in our backyard, basically. And it's called Ivan's Ecstasy, based on the death of Ivan Illich.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a sort of poison letter to Hollywood, but basically we stayed true to Tolstoy.
Yeah.
But as best we could. It's actually quite a faithful adaptation. And it became a success. It got Independent Film Spirit nominations, and it sort of propelled me as an actor. And the next thing I knew, I was working with Scorsese and with Nicole Kidman and on a film called Birth, and I was like, wow. I got to take this seriously.
Right.
Not that I wasn't, but I mean, I was like, this is actually happening.
But had you had any training at all?
None whatsoever. No, none. Life. Life was my training. And story. Story. That's what it's all about. I consider myself a storyteller.
Really. Sure, of course. Yeah, yeah. No, no, I know. Like, yeah. I talk to more actors than I used to, you know, and because I've been doing it a bit myself. But, you know, many of them come down to the storytelling. Yeah. That they're honoring a story.
Yeah.
And then other people get caught up in the nuance of acting, you know, in terms of, you know, tools they use or what have you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you just show up.
Try to show up. But yes, it's you know, and so basically from that point on, I was an actor. And what I love about it is, you know, my credo basically is try to work with people that I respect.
Right.
And so, from an acting point of view, I mean, you mentioned this earlier,
yeah,
about how much time it takes to direct. But from an acting point of view, I can be like a bee or something.
Right.
I can go and I can taste the nectar from different flowers.
Mm-hmm.
I can make three or four films per year if I'm lucky.
Acting.
I can maybe do a couple of TV shows or guest appearances. But I can keep active, and I can be working on many stories at the same time. Now this grinds to a halt when one is directing,
right?
Because you're turning other stuff down possibly, and you are just single-mindedly directing this. I mean, the last photograph, like you mentioned, it's two two and a half years ago that I started.
Oh, you started
making it, yeah. And finished it in a rather unconventional way. But it's taken a long time, and you need that dedication and that gumption to just keep.
Right.
Keep writing it
right.
until it gets seen.
Right.
And that's from the point of conception to the point of release.
So
it's a lot of time.
On some level, there's some element of rationalization in, you know, when you're taking, you know, four or five acting roles a year and you're sort of framing it as like, well, I get to experience how other directors work and stuff, that when you actually have to direct and focus your own energy on not doing any of that just for 2 years, there's got to be moments where it's sort of like, oh, can I get a job just to not finish this?
But yes, and at that point, the ideas possibly become a little tired for you,
yeah.
But you've become utterly obsessed.
Right. Oh, that's good. You have to.
Yeah. You can't let it go. I mean,
So you're also like, you're in Succession this season. I noticed you. I had no idea. I just started watching it, whatever, a couple weeks ago. That must be great to work with those guys.
It's fantastic. And
did you know Brian Cox?
I met him because we both played General Stryker. In the X-Men, so it was a very funny meeting in Edinburgh in Scotland, yeah. where it was like, oh, I'm playing you, no, I'm playing you, and we look completely different.
Yeah.
So it was great to see him again, and I love working with Brian. He's
where's he from? Is he British?
He's Scottish.
He's Scottish.
Yeah. Comes from hard Scottish background.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Like most of them, I guess.
I guess like most of them, yeah. I mean, we were in Dundee,
yeah.
And he showed me the apartment or the house where he grew up. It was seven families in one block.
Wow.
Maybe two, three floors. And
yeah.
And an outhouse that they all used.
Right.
They all had to use.
So when you do like over this process of doing, you know, obviously growing up a bit on your father's sets and then working a bit with Scorsese, with Figgis, with, you know, who are some of the other people that, you know, how do you, you know, what do you integrate into your directing craft from these experiences?
Well, the experience of making about four or five adaptations with Bernard Rose, Tolstoy adaptations. We did Ivan's Ecstasy, which is
That was your big break. Yeah. I don't know that I remember seeing the movie.
That's the death of Ivan Illich.
Right.
Then we made Boxing Day, which is Master and Man. Then we did the Kreutzer Sonata. We did the Two Jacks, which is the Two Hussars. I did that with my nephew. But what I really took from Bernard is his sort of unapologetic manner. He doesn't wait for anybody to tell him whether he can make a film or not. He just starts.
Yeah.
And then he tries to raise some money here and there. But he's kind of like a punk rocker, yeah, in that sense. He's like you starting these interviews in your garage.
Right.
You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just do it. Yeah. You just do it. You stop the concern about who's going to release it and worry how the backing is arranged financially. But, you know, that makes it difficult because you then need to get it out there, and
sure,
but it's a great unapologetic approach, and Mike Figgis was the same, you know, and so that's what I got from them. My father had to play the studio system.
Well, it was like his legacy.
Yeah, but we don't have to do that anymore.
If you've got
a guitar and you've got a good melody, bash it out in the garage and send it out. If it's good, it'll probably hit.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. But you got it out. You know, you've done it.
I mean, it's a good question. You've done it. That's true. You've completed it, and you've done the work of your heart.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting question about the way the fragmented media works now, and this ability to self-generate and put things out in the world. Is that the idea that, like, well, if it's great, it will find its place. I wonder how many geniuses are out there submerged.
Not necessarily. Yeah. You're absolutely right. The stars do need to align, and sometimes they don't, and the work is still possibly remarkable. I mean, how many great painters are out there that we don't know? How many Vincent van Goghs are out there that we don't know?
It's wild, right? But there is a lack of gatekeepers now. So
yeah,
and they were the ones that determined things. But also there, the other side of that, unfortunately, is not unlike some painters that you know if something exists out there in the world. You know, at the time it was released or created, it may not get any recognition, but you never know, 15, 20 years down the line, someone finds it and like, this guy was a died destitute.
Yes.
But what a gift.
Yes, also true.
Right.
Also absolutely true, yeah. But, you know, when you have the machinery in place, I have a film out these past couple of weeks called Angel Has Fallen, and that's with Jerry Butler, and that's a franchise, and it's like a freight train, you know. It's,
really,
it's kind of, you can't stop it, which is, you know, it's wonderful to be part of that. It's great to be in a number one film for a couple of weekends.
What is it? Is it a Marvel movie or something?
No, he plays a security for the president, and this is the third installment. You had Olympus Had Fallen, London Has Fallen, now it's Angel Has Fallen.
No shit.
And you know,
I don't even look at this cast. I don't even know what this movie is. Where am I living? And it's a huge movie?
It's a huge movie. It's a huge success. But my point—
In movie theaters?
In practically every— that is actually my point. It's in practically every movie theater. And my film, The Last Photograph, is playing in one theater nationwide. It's Santa Monica at the Lamley Theater.
That's your strategy?
That's for 1 week.
You got to fly in.
For 1 week. And you know, then it'll go on the video demand and all the digital platforms, et cetera, which I'm perfectly happy with this film because there's something quite private about the experience
of that movie.
I think that
might be true.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes against my sense of what it should be, but yeah.
I'm delighted that it's going to be up on the big screen for a week or so.
No, yeah, I mean, I was just in a movie like that where just to be in a theater at all, I guess, it's an exciting thing.
Yeah.
So there's no chance that it will pick up more theaters, or you don't?
I don't think so. I think it's all geared towards the 1 week theatrical release.
Yeah,
and then into your home.
So what was the journey of this movie, though? Why did it take so long? Did you do the festivals? What was the process of The Last Photograph?
We did the festivals.
Yeah.
We did Edinburgh Film Festival, which was very poignant evening with Alistair Stewart, who was one of the newscasters who announced the Lockerbie.
Oh,
Pan Am 101.
I guess it is really sort of relevant in how, like, there are these tragedies that happen through acts of terrorism that seem to require the victims, the survivors, you know, live in a sort of blame, you know, to find some sort of justice. Like it's relevant because these shootings, like you said, because there's so many things like this that create these type of the families of victims.
Yeah. The Pan Am 101 fight was complicated. We don't really know where the blame lies.
There are very
many conspiracy theories.
It was attached to Libya initially, right?
Well, you know, finally, I believe it was Cheney who negotiated a deal with Gaddafi, where Gaddafi gave money to the families of the victims as a means to lift sanctions off. And then Blair and Bush were able to have business with Libya again.
Right.
So, you know, Gaddafi accepted the blame by paying the families, but never actually said it was him. So we don't really know. There was a man who was prosecuted in Scotland, who was released and brought back home to Libya, because he was dying of cancer, I believe. Uh-huh. And we don't really know. We don't really know. But it's, what we do know is that this was one of the first, terrorist, hits of that, That size.
Right.
Many Americans.
Yeah.
I think the biggest terrorist act over English soil.
Right.
It was the beginning of what has happened.
Sure. So okay. So you do the event with Alistair in
yes,
Edinburgh.
That was magical. And then the other event was a screening at Mill Valley, which was during the fires
last year.
Yeah. So that was tough. But everybody was very I don't know about willing, but they were open to a film about loss.
Yeah. Interesting. And then what is the process of, like, I don't know, like, I've talked to Sophie Huber about her recent documentary, the Blue Note documentary. Then I sort of talked to her about that to help her in, because I love the movie, get it out there in the world. And I work with Lynn Shelton, independent film director, who's great. And we did a small movie, but like, so it goes to festivals, then you try to sell it or get a distributor or how?
Yes, exactly. You go, it goes to festivals, you hope you'll...
Who financed it originally?
Private financing that came through Simon Astaire.
Oh, okay.
A man called Hans Rausing.
Yeah.
Just
an investor?
Yeah, an investor.
Uh-huh.
Rather charitable investor.
I think they all are when it comes to independent film, right?
Yeah. The film didn't cost a lot of money, but still, you know, you need money to make it. You hope that you garner good reviews, that the audience is supportive.
Yeah.
And that there's maybe a few people there that might want decide to pick up the film,
right?
And we were lucky enough to find Freestyle, who are releasing it for us.
Wow, and that was a 2-year process,
if not longer. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Probably longer.
All right, so let's talk about these. Now the Marvel movies for a minute.
Certainly.
You were in X-Men Origins of Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you know when you get one of these roles, like a role like that, I think the other ones. By the way, I loved Stan and Ollie. I think anybody involved in film should see that movie.
Yeah,
and you were great as Hal Roach. Yeah, it was not. It's not a huge part, but it's a good part.
Yeah, I know. I was just so again, as far as like, you know, tasting the nectar off of different. That was the perfect example of me being able to go there, work for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah,
and see these two guys who just were remarkable,
it's crazy,
and you know, from the prosthetics to their movements, it was. I was gobsmacked. I forgot my dialogue because they looked.
I couldn't believe it.
So unbelievable.
And the mannerisms.
Yes.
Both of them, but Coogan was like the detail.
Yeah.
Because Stan Laurel was like this twitchy. It was a tricky business.
Yeah.
It was.
And it's heartwarming, isn't it?
I loved it. Yeah. I love that movie.
Yeah.
So when you get these, like, as an actor, because like I'm wrestling with my own trip here. But whatever you may think of movies or what their, you know, what their place in culture is, or if they're doing actual damage to the form, you know, as an actor, you make a choice as an actor, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's money involved, but I mean, we're not talking a fortune, but you want to work. And, you know, I guess not unlike your father directing, movies that he may not have wanted to direct in order to stay in the game and do the stuff he wants to do. You know, you'd somehow, I guess, show up with as much as you as possible and engage in it as, you know, as an artist that you are without judging it.
Yeah, but, okay. The number of people I've met who have said, "Oh, Annie was when I was a kid, I loved
sure.
that movie."
Yeah.
The entertainment value that film has to lift you out of your daily,
right,
possibly dull or
right.
or life where you're you're suffering. You need a little lightness. You need something to lift you up a little bit. I think to judge these films too harshly is possibly unfair. What I try to do from an acting point of view is I just try to find the key into the character.
Yeah.
With Wonder Woman, for example, General Ludendorff. In story terms, he basically wants to exterminate mankind.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But in truth, he was a real man. He existed, Ludendorff. He was humiliated in battle. He lost his son on the German front. And it's all about, you know, which we're seeing a lot of today, that nationalistic pride.
Yeah.
And I spoke to Patty Jenkins about this, and once we started to get our head around this guy and understand him, understood the machinations.
Right.
Then I was able to portray the horror in a more entertaining way, and go a little bit more arch.
Right.
with him.
Once you understood his own heartbreak.
Yes. Yes. However sinister. That may have.
That's
been
one way to go.
Yeah. And I had a line on a film that I did called The Constant Gardener, where my character says, "Well, those patients would have died anyway." And he's talking about African Kenyans who are dying of AIDS, and they're experimenting drugs on them.
Yeah.
And I found that line so horrific. But if I could say it and mean it, then maybe I'd have the character down, you know? So that's what I'm looking for. I'm getting that scalpel out and dissecting and prodding and seeing how these guys are and how they feel, and not necessarily honoring their evil doings, but understanding where it comes from. And I think that great novels, paintings, poetry is able to do that. You're able to understand other than you,
right?
Or break down this thing of them and us,
right?
And that's I find that fascinating from a psychological point of view as well.
Right. So you just rise to the challenge and figure out, like, when you get offered these roles that are broad, you know what the guts of it is.
Yeah, but I mean, I kind of to do justice.
Yeah.
For the film, primarily, I have to figure out a way in. If I can't find it, then I can't really do it. I shouldn't be doing it.
And that's interesting, though, because it comes down to sometimes just a script reading, a line in the script. Like, if I can wrap my brain around this.
Yes, yes. I remember a story my father's with Katharine Hepburn when he was making African Queen. Katharine Hepburn couldn't figure out the character, really, because she was having trouble with it. So she goes up to my father. She goes, "John, I don't know. I don't know who this woman is." So my father paused a moment and said, looked at her and said, "Eleanor Roosevelt." And she went, "Ah, okay, I get it." And sometimes that's all an actor needs. It's just a little key into who they're portraying.
That's so now. Okay, so now I'm gonna I think I gotta just go out and watch some of these movies. I've been pushing back on them. Now, Angel Has Fallen, like, that's a whole franchise. No idea it even existed.
Right.
You're in all of them?
No, only this last one.
Did you see it?
I saw it, yeah.
You like it?
Yes, I like it. It is, as I said, the antithesis of The Last Photograph. This is a fun shoot 'em up movie. But what I liked about my key into that, actually, but what a lot of the other actors are portraying are men that are damaged from war, men that cannot become part of what we consider a civilized environment. They've been trained to to be lions,
yeah.
and they do not understand a peaceful state. They need the adrenaline to feel alive.
Right.
Wheat or grass moving in the fields for them is a potential enemy that's lurking below.
Right. You know? Right.
They're on another level.
Yeah.
And that was what was interesting to me.
Cool. All right. Well, that okay. So that I seem to be moving towards this, engaging in this, in these movies, and just being. I think what I'm afraid of is I'll just love them. Well,
that's right.
And then I'm going to be that guy, the guy who railed against them. And I'm like, these are so fun. I don't want to be the fun guy. Well, I'll tell you, it's been great talking to you, Danny.
It was great talking to you.
Thanks for coming. And I will share the love of that movie, of your movie.
Thanks.
It's great hearing these stories. And we'll see where it ends. We don't know where it's going to end up after the film. It'll be on iTunes and Netflix.
It'll be on all the digital. Yes, exactly. It'll be on pay-per-view and DirecTV, and then it'll go to Hulu.
The streaming and stuff?
Yeah, and all the usual streamings.
Tremendous. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming over.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, again, The Last Photograph, now in theaters. And now I will play my Stratocaster for you. For those of you asking me about settings on this thing, I'm really just going straight into the old 58 Fender Deluxe with an Echoplex pedal and different levels of volume. But no Echoplex pedal on what I'm about to do now. Just a crybaby, straight up crybaby wah. A no frills wah, wah. Boomer lives.